everyone, and welcome back to the Next Lander Watchcast. I am your host and the author of your nightmares, Alex Navarro, and I am here to take you straight in to the mouth of madness.
Ew.
Yeah, no, it's not, they haven't brushed in there in a while, it's pretty bad.
Did the mouth of madness floss?
The mouth of madness definitely has not seen a dentist in at least 10 years.
The Math of Madness was very excited when that weird news came out. That's like, is flossing really that helpful? Math of Madness was like, well, good, I never floss.
Wait, is flossing not that helpful? What?
You don't remember that whole thing? This is a different.
This is a different podcast.
And dentists were like, no, you should floss. And they're like, studies show flossing. Is flossing that useful? Dentists
don't toss the floss.
Don't toss the floss.
Says the National Institute of Health.
Mm-hmm. Well, they would know. But that's
you know what? That's Sutter Kane's forthcoming opus, Don't Toss the Floss.
Don't tell you got to cut the cover out on that one.
Hobbs Floss. Vinny Caravella, are you ready to take a journey into the maw of loopiness?
Yeah, you know, I was telling you before we started recording, once I started watching this, I was like, oh, I've seen this before, but my memories are very scattered and nonsensical. And then when I finished the movie, I think I felt like I was in the same place.
Uh-huh. Like you somehow came all the way, full circle, back to where you were.
Like I came back to being like, oh, maybe I did see this from start to finish at some point, because it makes about as much sense to me now as my memory of it did. Brad, had you seen this before?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I was aware of it when it came out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 15 when this movie came out, so...
It's much more recent than some of the other stuff we've been watching.
Like, I remember this coming out in a way that obviously the thing coming out when I was 3, I did not.
Yes.
But, go on.
Okay.
I'll reserve judgment until we talk about the movie.
Okay.
Had you seen this before?
Oh, yeah. No, so I even remember when I saw this movie for the first time. I didn't see it in theaters, but I remember I was probably about 15 or 16 when I saw it. It was when it was on home video. And I remember me and my childhood best friend, his parents were out of town for the weekend. So we went and rented a grip of horror movies to just fucking sit around and, you know, eat junk food and watch horror movies all weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, we grabbed the original It miniseries.
Okay.
We grabbed Needful Things. Another Stephen King adaptation. There were a couple of other ones in there, like random, like Nightmare on Elm Street sequels or whatever. And then we grabbed this, and I remember watching it at the time and being like, So I had never really read any Lovecraft. I didn't really know much about, like, you know, the stuff that this movie had kind of inspired by. But at the time, I was like, this whips. Like, this kicks ass.
Oh, okay.
And it has only kind of grown in esteem for me over time. I think it is genuinely the last great Carpenter movie.
Wow. Oh.
Hmm.
Okay. I don't know where the line goes from here, so I'd have to look.
So the one after this is John Carpenter's Vampires, and it's kind of a decline from there.
Okay. And then there's obviously Ghosts of Mars after this.
Yes, there's Ghosts of Mars, there's The Ward, which was the last movie he made, which was direct-to-video, and no one saw
Okay.
But
so
I think
this
movie
isn't faint praise. This is, you genuinely like this movie.
Yeah, no, I think this, I mean, I don't think it's in my top three, but it is definitely like number four or number five on my overall Carpenter list.
Okay, all right. It's a weird one. Oh, so is there anything production-wise with this? Because it kind of just seems... I'm going to say, looking at it, it's from The Thing and Prince of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Those seem like they have really interesting production stories. This one feels a little bit more like a movie.
Yes.
Like a movie that maybe I'm not going to be shocked by what happened in it. Or
yeah.
The production.
No, there's not too much shocking here in the production, but there are a couple of notes here. So this was written by Michael DeLuca, and the notable thing about this is that it is one of, like, only three movies that Michael DeLuca ever wrote.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in. When I saw that in the credits, though, I was like, man, that name sounds really familiar.
And it should be, because he was the head of production at New Line Cinema
for
many years.
Okay, then.
And, like, he's the guy who, like, put movies like Seven and Boogie Nights and Austin Powers and Blade, all that stuff, into production.
Okay. Huh.
But the only the only other movies he ever wrote were Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, and he co-wrote the Stallone Judge Dredd.
Okay. Hey, those are not lightweights.
Okay. I don't know about that. They're movies. I'll say that. They got made.
I thought people like Freddy's Dead in kind of the same way people like Stallone's Dread.
No.
Okay.
Freddy's Dead is the one that straight up turns him into like a Warner Brothers cartoon.
That's the point. Isn't that funny? Isn't it good?
Is that the one that gets all meta?
No, that's New Nightmare, which is
New
actually
Nightmare.
Great.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Freddy's Dead is not good.
Okay. Great. Sounds like something I need to see.
This project was originally pitched to Carpenter. It was the first director they went after, and he turned it down initially. And it was almost going to be directed by this dude named Tony Randall. Not that Tony Randall. It's a different Tony Randall, who was the guy who directed Hellraiser 2 and a number of other things, including a live action HBO adaptation of Fist of the North Star.
Oh, okay.
In the mid 90s. I had no idea this existed until I read up on this.
You're already dead.
It looks like trash, and I kind of want to see it.
That's great.
The movie itself was made entirely in Canada. It was shot in Toronto and around a town called Unionville. And that church that you see in the film is a real cathedral called the Cathedral of the Transfiguration. It is a Greek Catholic church.
Huh. Okay.
That they only did a little bit of dressing on the outside to change, and that was it.
Okay.
Most of the production kind of went into the special effects here. The 18-foot wall of monsters that shows up for about 30 seconds in the movie was the big one. That took like 7 weeks to put together and required 25 people to animate.
Jeez.
Yeah. And the last bit here is actually, I think that it'll lead us into the movie here, and one of my favorite parts of the whole thing is the opening theme.
Guitar?
Yeah, dude. So like, this was written by Carpenter, and the guitar is Dave Davies of the Kinks.
Okay.
All right.
And
it was one of my few notes on this movie was like this opening theme, Carpenter?
Yes, it's Carpenter, and it shreds so hard.
I mean, we'll get into my feelings on the film, but the intro is the best part of this movie. Like that song, that whole thing fucking rules. Also,
yeah.
If you haven't watched the commentary of this, you might, I don't know, just check that out. It's Carpenter and his DP. And first of all, about 80% of the commentary is him, like, literally grilling his DP on, like, so how'd you light this one? Like, how many lights did you, like, what kind of lights did you, like, Kino flows? Like, it was literally just, like, quizzing the DP about every technical aspect of every shot in this movie. But he goes into a lot of detail about them shooting this whole intro, like, at a printing facility.
Yeah, John Carpenter's How It's Made.
He seems like a real film nerd, like a technical film nerd.
Oh, yeah. That's, like, his whole shtick.
Yeah, like, it's really interesting if you're interested in film production stuff, like him talking about them getting into that printing facility and shooting that whole intro, but that intro rules.
It rules, and so a small detail that I really love about this is that he originally wanted to just license Enter Sandman for the beginning of this movie, and when they couldn't get the rights, this is what he wrote to fill in for Enter Sandman, and when you listen to it, you can kind of hear it.
I have to check it out again. All right.
Yeah, but that, I love the intro. I love that theme shreds so much harder than it has any right to. It's what he opened with when I saw him perform live, and it definitely set the tone.
Great. Wait, what does he play on stage?
He mostly plays keyboards. Occasionally, I think he busts out a guitar, but usually he's on the keyboards.
Okay.
But yeah, so the movie itself. We get this intro sequence of books being printed. It is the author, Sutter Kane. Who is, by all accounts, one of the, let's just say, the biggest horror writer currently going in this movie universe. But before we get to meet him or find out what's going on with that guy, we are introduced to Sam Neill's character, John Trent, who is being wheeled into, let's just say, a hospital for the mentally disturbed.
Yeah, like the cliche cartoon version of one.
Yes. Yeah, this is full on cliche sanitarium.
Yes,
like white lab coats,
padded rooms.
Yes,
straitjacket, the whole nine yards. And he's not doing well. He's having some problems. He's very upset. He kicks a guy in the balls on his way in.
You have to listen to that commentary. Carpenter's quip about that kick in the balls is very good.
What does he say?
I can't remember. He predicts it. He said like 3 seconds before it happens. He's like, so and so extra here is about to take a kick in the ball. Like I just, just very, very mechanical about it. It's very funny.
That and Sam Neill's delivery a minute later of
"I'm sorry about the balls"
is just great acting all around. And so yes, he is brought to this asylum. He is very quickly interviewed by David Warner. Who I'm sure you've seen him probably in a number of things.
I was very excited that David Warner was in this, and then really sad by the end that he's barely in it.
Yeah, he's only got about 5 minutes of screen time, but you know, he makes good use of it. Yeah. But he is there to interview him and find out what's going on, and there's some allusions here to a bigger event, a thing that is taking place where people are starting to go crazy and cause violence and havoc. And in the meantime, Sam Neill has taken up sketch art in his room, drawing crosses on everything.
They say they gave him, like, did you give him anything? We got one black crayon. And he has, let me tell you, someone who has kids and has seen a lot of crayons, that's not how crayons work. You can't really draw on your face like a grease pencil with a crayon, and that crayon would have been done. He covered the entire room in crosses and his face and his pajamas.
I'm willing to give a little bit of artistic license here to the movie and just say that, like, look, it's a good visual. All right, just let it be.
It does it. Not that anything's supposed to make sense, but I'm not sure why he's doing it.
I think he's doing it because he's trying to ward off evil.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that he has any other real way to do that.
It's just what if he had garlic, he would also be eating it kind of thing.
Yeah,
okay, fair
like
enough.
He would be just like drenching himself in holy water if they gave it to him.
Right. Okay. Fair. This is what he had.
Yeah. And then so the rest of this movie is told in flashback of Trent telling the doctor what led to his mental breakdown. And it's quite a yarn, my friends.
You're waiting to hear about my them, aren't you? You know what? My them. Not every paranoid schizophrenic has one. A them, a they, an it. You want to hear about my them, don't you? I want to know how you got here. Things are turning to shit out there, aren't they? Let's talk about you. Your dime. I was an insurance investigator, freelance. Checked out phony claims, frauds, usual kind of thing. And lately I'd been working for a firm here in the city. And all of this started with the disappearance. The Sutter Kane disappearance.
Oh, Trent's badass.
I definitely enjoyed finding out rapidly that he is a gigantic asshole.
Oh, he's not an asshole. He's just good at what he does. Bringing down cons.
That's the thing. He's the asshole that gets the other assholes.
He's not a claims adjuster. He's basically like
he's a fixer.
PI.
He's an investigator.
He's a fixer.
Yeah. So like if somebody files an insurance claim, they hire John Trentier to go make sure it's a legit claim. But he's the best in the business.
I kind of got the vibe though. It's more than him just like doing the legwork, the fact checking, and more that they approach every claim from a position of this is probably fraudulent.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just colored by my experience with insurance companies, let's say.
But they seem to reserve him mostly for the big stuff though. Like the guy he's grilling at the beginning, you know, it's a big warehouse fire. There's all these fur coats and stuff that were destroyed or whatever. And that's Peter Jason, who you may have seen in Prince of Darkness. He was your cigar smoking guy who got taken over.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, and you will see him again, I believe, in They Live when we do that one next week. And Bertie Casey is there briefly as the guy who is the insurance company guy. But he has another job for John Trent, for a big publishing house. It seems that one of their authors has gone missing right before his next novel is about to come out.
Yeah.
And Here we meet Chuck Heston, baby.
Dude, I fucking like fell out of my chair when Charlton Heston popped up in the credits. I was like, what?
Well, before that, he gets attacked by the publicist. Don't forget. He's meeting with Robinson with Bernie Casey.
Oh, you're right. That does happen before then. Yes. He's meeting with Bernie Casey, and then they're having a diner meal, and then an axe wielding madman just comes out of the woodwork and just straight up crashes through the window and gives the best line delivery of the entire movie.
You know, most of my salesmen couldn't sniff out a phony claim if their noses were nailed to it. But you, man, you never miss.
Must have missed. You learn to expect the worst in people and you get it. Everyone's looking to play an angle. I'm always there to clean up the mess. I tell you what. Stop freelancing. Join my staff. I'll make it worth your while, Trent. Forget it, Robbie. I'm an own man. Nobody pulls my strings. I'm independent. I'm happy.
Well, be my man one more time. I'm having quite a difficult mess with Arcane.
Publishing house?
Yeah, it's my biggest account. They just filed a claim. It cost me millions. I want you on this right away.
What's the claim?
Sutter Kane's missing.
Who?
Sutter Kane.
Do you read Sutter Kane?
Do you read Sutter Kane?
Do you read Sutter Kane? I have been saying that line in varying inflections for like 20 something years now to nothing, to no one. It's just, it is a line that lives rent free in my head.
Also, he's bleeding from the eyes, and then in the close up, you see that he's got two pupils.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's got that like weird.
Which is another fun John Carpenter commentary moment of he just very matter of factly is like, oh, he's got a little thing in his eyes. It's just like, anyway.
I like the double pupil. That's a good one.
It's very gross looking.
So Axeman, you know, kind of gives the signal that maybe something is amiss here, something is going wrong.
He is dealt with and the situation is resolved.
Yes.
Before, yeah.
The way the cops tend to deal with things, which is just shoot the fuck out of the guy.
They just open fire on him.
In this case, the guy had a fire axe that was going to kill.
He was about to cleave Sam Neill's head into... Yeah.
But that can't happen, and we'll find out why that is the case later. But yes, they meet with Chuck Heston, and they lay out this situation, which is that Sutter Kane, the world's biggest horror novelist, has indeed gone missing. No one knows where he is, and it's up to Sam Neill, John Trent, to go find him.
So, Mr. Trent, are you familiar with Arcane?
Well, aside from the fact that you're insured by the company I work for, I never heard of Arcane, I'm sorry.
You read books?
Linda Stiles, John Trent. Linda reads books for a living. She's one of our best editors. Since she joined the firm, she's been handling Sutter Kane exclusively.
Sutter Kane? Isn't he the guy that writes that horror crap?
Maybe he's too sophisticated for you. Sutter Kane happens to be this century's most widely read author. You can forget about Stephen King. Kane outsells them all.
So what happened to this cash cow of yours?
Kane disappeared 2 months ago without a trace. The police have turned up nothing.
Who was the last person to hear from him?
His agent. Kane mailed him several chapters of his new book, not 2 weeks ago. Plain brown wrapper, no return address.
What'd the agent have to say?
Well, you heard what he had to say.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, I understand you were there when the poor man went crazy in Midtown Manhattan. You witnessed the shooting, I believe.
That lunatic with the axe, that was Kane's agent?
Hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you'd think a guy that outsells Stephen King could find better representation.
Also, it's established that there are riots because there are not enough copies of Sutter Kane's new book available in stores. If only society actually had such a burning desire to read books.
Yes. Well, they claim the riots are because of people can't get their hands on it. But it is it's Charlton Heston is the head of the publishing company, and Sutter Cain is supposed to be getting in his next book, the manuscript for his next book, Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
And they can't get pre-orders for Mouth of Madness in the stores, and people are apparently just losing their shit because they can't get their pre-orders in for their book, which is also amazing to get your pre-order in for your book. And so the publishing company, Charlton Heston, is like, this guy's a billion-dollar franchise. He's missing. We're going to make our insurance claim. What is he? He says something that really sums it up is either we want our money for the liability that, you know, the money we had lost because we lost our asset, Sutter Cain, or we want the manuscript. These are the two things.
All that matters.
Yeah, that's all that matters.
There's also a good Stephen King name drop just like to establish. Forget Stephen King, Sutter Cain outsells them all.
Yes. Yes.
That comes from our editor here, Linda Stiles, played by Julie Carmen. I looked up Carmen's catalog. I mean, she's done a fair amount of acting, but she and I kind of thought this before I even read this, but like she eventually went on to become a psychotherapist. And the thing is, that woman has the most psychotherapist face I've ever seen in my life.
Like I'm watching that scene, right? It's not just her face, like her whole getup, the glasses, the hair up in kind of a top bun sort of thing, like just screams like cliche movie psychologists.
Yes.
Kind of sitting there like dryly taking notes, listening to the person babble.
But here she is the editor, and she is the person that has edited all of Sutter Cain's works up to this point. And
is a fan. A Sutter Cain fan.
And there's a lot of Sutter Cain fans out there, as we learned, but John Trent is not one of them.
Oh, John Trent's not having any of this malarkey.
Total classic, like hard-assed skeptic type.
What does he say? Hogwash, hogwash. It's all hogwash. It's all hogwash. And also, is he supposed to be like a slime ball or just like a hard nose? What is his character?
He seems kind of like a slime ball to me.
Okay, because like he corners her at the elevator in a very close thing. Hey, maybe we can go over some Sutter Cain stuff. And she's like,
Just go read his books.
Oh yeah, well there's more we'll get to. Like he's kind of an asshole. Like the way he wakes her up in the car later.
Oh my gosh, yes.
He's an asshole. He makes some off-color joke at the end of this meeting with Charlton Heston. I forget what the joke is, but it seems like that did not go over well.
He's just kind of an asshole and thinks that they're faking it.
Also, I don't know that I've seen Charlton Heston in much before. He's a fine actor.
I mean,
he can act.
If you weren't watching a lot of movies from like the 50s and 60s, I could very easily see how that'd be the case. I feel like maybe the only thing you might have seen him in was Planet of the Apes.
Hmm.
But yes, I mean, look, Chuck Heston, notorious asshole in real life, but also a fine actor of his time.
Yeah.
There were a lot of those. But so, yes, the mission is on, and before they decide, you know, before they really set off on their journey here, there's a little bit of puzzle solving that has to take place. And, you know, Trent, you know, he does his research. He goes and he buys copies of all the books.
Yep.
He encounters a nerd and is bothered by the nerd as he's buying these books.
A nerd with just a little bit of blood on his face.
Yeah, no big deal. I mean, we've all had that. We're teenagers once, you know.
Uh-huh. What does he say? I see you. He sees you.
What in the world is happening? I can see.
Excuse me?
He sees you.
Right, tell him I say hi.
Something like that. Yeah, he's a just classic asshole response. We'll tell him I said hi.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'll just point out, my girlfriend was like, man, I wish hardcover books were still $5.99.
Oh my gosh. Wait, those were paperbacks he got, though, right?
Were they?
I think he got paperbacks because he rips them up. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. He cuts up the...
Oh, I think this was in the store. I think there was a display.
Okay, yeah, the price was very good for what he was getting.
Early 90s book prices definitely seemed a lot more appealing than they are now.
But I thought it was $5.99 for the paperbacks.
Maybe those are, I'm looking at it now, those might just be large size, like a large format paperbacks.
The trade paperback, is that the big one?
Okay.
He buys them all. There's just five, right? Five-ish?
There's five that are already out, and the sixth one is the one that is not out yet. And so he reads them. He starts to have, you know, let's say some unsettling dreams. And
he
then
he comes around a little. He tells his boss, like, hey, you know, this stuff is gets you, man. It's maybe it's because it's well written, or maybe because it's the descriptions. But like, you know, it kind of gets inside your head.
Has a way of getting to you.
It's
also fun to note that Carpenter really likes that dream within a dream technique.
Oh my gosh,
it's a great technique. Like, it's always effective.
The same thing that Prince of Darkness ends with. You get that here again.
But you also get Sam Neill in around this time frame when he's doing all his research. He keeps walking by this the Dark Knight, can only be described as a Batman the Dark Knight alleyway, where
yes,
it just
Thomas and Martha Wayne are getting beat up by the cops.
somebody had sprayed Joker gas or whatever in that alleyway, and there's just this one alley that is just straight out of a different movie that is just ridiculous, and the cops are beating graffiti people, the people spray painting, putting up,
yes,
and it's just ridiculous. And then he keeps having nightmares about it.
And then, you know, as he's kind of going through the motions here, he stumbles upon a dark secret in the cover art for the books.
Did he find this? Because it still didn't make sense. Are there little
lines?
There are little red squiggles on every cover.
Didn't see it that well.
He started to realize they fit together.
Yeah, just cutting along those lines and then putting the puzzle together.
And I'm going to say this right now. This is maybe the only part of the movie that I will say maybe does not 100% work for me, is that this dark puzzle that they solve is just a map of New Hampshire.
I thought that was hilarious.
It's funny. Funny.
And it's something pinpoints it to a spot, right?
There's like a red dot on one of the covers that inside the map that he assumes, like, oh, that must be where the town is that he's hiding out.
I thought that was good, and I thought it was also good that they throw in one line there from Sam Neill who says, this is why he insisted on doing all his own covers. And I was like, okay, good. I'm glad you explained that somebody else usually does the cover art and not the author.
Yeah, but the thing that I like is that what it results in, which is one of my favorite things in horror, of a place that should not exist.
Yeah.
That's cool. I was super into the setup of the movie all the way up to this point. This is about the point, though, where they start pulling the thing that is my primary beef with this movie, which is abundant overuse of dreams and hallucinations.
What do you mean by overuse?
There's just a lot of it. We'll get into it later when they start landing on thicker.
Okay.
Like, yeah, I don't know if we've seen enough of it yet at this point, but anyway, the drive to the town, though, was good because, like, I like a little bit of grounding in my hallucinations, like the transition into the town. Well, let's just talk about it. The drive there.
Yeah.
The weird Large Marge Pee-wee's Big Adventure drive, the endless road trip.
So here's the setup is that, yes, the town Hobbs End, which is the town that features prominently in some of Kane's works, but is not supposed to be a real place. That is where he is supposedly going.
I didn't even make the connection. That's basically the Castle Rock of this movie.
Yes,
totally. And I think Hob is, I looked it up, Hob actually is an old world word for devil. So, you know,
oh yeah, I just played that excavation of Hob's Barrow, don't forget.
Ooh, that's true, you did.
Hobgoblin.
The Hobbs are huge right now. Everyone's all about the Hobbs.
Straight hobbing over here.
Yeah, but so they take a little road trip.
It's Stiles and Trent.
Stiles and Trent.
Charles and Heston send Stiles along.
Yes, as a chaperone, kind of.
Yeah, you know, representing the company's interests.
I mean, this is the point I need to fill in that I mentioned earlier, where she's dozing in the passenger seat, and he straight up pulls like a clown horn out of the glove box.
And why does he have
it, like,
that?
3 inches from her face, and just starts squeaking it.
Sea to shiny,
what was it? What?
Hey, you're awake.
Hey,
what did I do?
And he's an asshole.
And to be fair, she is like, what the hell are you doing? Like, why are you such a dick? I don't know.
Here's what I believe. I believe that John Carpenter has done that on more than one occasion to on a car ride.
Oh, don't say that.
I believe that that seems like the kind of joke he would play on someone.
Oh, man. Wow. Huh. I just made a weird connection. I was going to ask, this is the point in the movie where I started going, is Sam Neill putting on an Australian accent in this?
Oh, he's like half, isn't he?
And then I just looked it up, and he's from New Zealand. I had no idea. I thought he was British.
No, he's from New Zealand.
I think doesn't he have a British mom or dad? Like, one parent is Irish or
Northern? Yes, he was born in Northern Ireland, actually.
Okay.
But I guess he's listed as New Zealandish or
I think he grew up in New Zealand, and he has a farm in New Zealand. I don't know if either of you follow Sam Neill on Twitter. He is one of the only, like, famous actor pro follows I will recommend on social media, because it is deeply wholesome. It is literally just him posting photos with his farm animals.
Does he have a winery or a vineyard?
Yes, it is a vineyard, but also it is a farm.
Okay.
Wait, hang on. Is this his account? Is his Twitter handle really Two Paddocks?
Yes, it is.
That's amazing.
I think that's the name of his winery.
Oh, that is actually
it?
The name of his business.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
He seems like he's living a real good life these days.
Man,
and good on
him.
Wow,
look at that.
Truly one of my favorite actors.
I did go look him up after this, because just a quick side tangent here. After seeing him in this, I was like, was Sam Neill mostly known for horror movies? Because really, my knowledge of Sam Neill is now Mouth of Madness is the space one. What is it?
Event Horizon.
Event Horizon. And, you know, Jurassic Park, which for all intents and purposes is kind of supposed to be a horror movie, but
it's
still
giant
budget
horror.
Yeah, it's like, you know, family friendly horror. So, like, was he cast as like a horror, like a horror actor?
Here's the thing. Like, he's done other stuff that obviously wasn't horror that he's relatively well known for. But, like, I think a lot of his biggest roles really just kind of fell into that category. Like, he also was in the 1981 movie Possession. He was the grown-up Damien in one of the Omen sequels.
Oh, wow.
Like, yeah, he kind of got typecast at a certain point, but the thing is, he's really good at it.
He is good at it. He is good.
And when you're really good at something, why not just keep doing it?
Should we take it back to the car?
Let's take it back to the car, because this car ride is great. This is, I think, like, it's like you said, this is a great transitional moment into kind of where things start to go off the rails. And the whole section where Stiles is driving the car is fantastic.
Okay, by fantastic, if you mean she hits somebody on a bicycle and then Sam Neill tells her to get back in and continue driving, terrible. Like, she should not be driving anymore. She clearly should have pulled over to take a rest. She is hallucinating. She should not be behind the wheel at all. Sam Neill is mostly sleeping during this part.
But they did hit someone, and the thing is, they got right back up and got back on the bike, and this person, who I'm just going to say looks like Spike Jones in Jackass old person makeup.
It's terrible. It's maybe the worst makeup from a Carpenter movie yet. It looks like somebody grabbed a Halloween mask off the rack and went like, I'll just go trick-or-treating with you guys. That's okay.
But it's also disturbing. Like, it's kind of disturbing looking, especially when it goes from, it morphs from that teenager who looks like they are desperately trying to flee something into this ancient, you know, crone makeup.
Won't let me leave.
Yeah.
Won't let me leave.
Just don't move. You'll get a blanket. Lie still.
I can't get out.
Don't
move. You won't let me out.
It's, yeah. That is like the most Stephen King-y part, I feel like, of the whole movie is that little bit. But then there's the part where she's driving along and then suddenly the road disappears and the car is basically floating through the ether.
Yep. Yep, she's driving a sky car.
Oh, but yes, that's when she looks down and sees like clouds and thunder beneath the car.
Want to pull over maybe and take a rest.
Like, that was a good effect, and then this whole bridge sequence I thought was like kind of amazing.
Yep, you get this cool Willy Wonka's nightmare tunnel bridge sequence.
Because they've been driving in the middle of the night. I think the time is mentioned at one point. It's like
1:40 or something.
1 in the morning, 3 in the morning, something like that, and then there's this chaotic scene and like going through a bridge, and all of a sudden she it's a covered bridge. She pops out the other side of the covered bridge, and it's just daytime.
Yeah,
and they're in the town. And I was
she
like,
found
oh,
it.
Wow, that was a good version of the type of hallucination I would like to see.
Yeah, it's very disorienting. Like the stuff with like the constant shooting of the lights around her and stuff right before it drops into the covered bridge. And, you know, of course, Sam Neill just wakes up. It's like, oh, hey, you got us here in record time. Fantastic.
Great job,
you found it.
Good job, Stiles.
I can't believe it. I must have slept through the whole night. Hey, thanks for driving. What is it?
Look.
Stiles, you're fantastic. You found it. What's wrong?
You drive.
And so they are now in Hobbs End.
A town that shouldn't exist.
A town that shouldn't exist. And pretty quickly, Stiles starts to figure out that, like, not only should this town not exist, this town should not exist in the way that is exactly described in Sutter Kane's books, but it does.
Yeah. Yeah. I did enjoy the part where she's like basically calling every detail of the hotel lobby they're in. It's like, oh, there should be a painting behind us. And like, oh, that board is going to be loose when you step on it.
Yeah.
And then the proprietor comes out and she straight up is named the name of the old lady axe murderer from the previous novel.
Shout out to Frances Bay, one of the great old lady actresses of our generation.
She's really good.
And that painting is like the stuff they do with that painting over the course of the movie, I feel like, is a really good subtle effect that is very creepy, where the painting, like, the characters will sometimes start moving around, start staring at you, and then they sort of kind of devolve over time into more grotesque things. Like, it's a subtle, easy thing to do, but like, it was, when I was a kid and I saw that thing, I was like, I'd never want to look at a painting again.
Yeah, it's very Haunted Mansion at Disney World, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So at this point, Stiles does not know, has not seen the Mouth of Madness manuscript, right? All this stuff is from the previous books.
Well,
the editor, Stiles is the editor, right?
Yeah.
No, she has read it. She has read it.
She
and the agent were the only two people that had read it before he disappeared.
Okay.
And the thing was, they hadn't seen the ending yet, I don't think, because that was the only part that hadn't been written
That's
yet.
What it was. Yeah, sorry, I forgot. Yeah, yeah. So she is like, some of this stuff is from the new stuff. And the kids chasing the dog, is that in the new one as well? Because that's pretty creepy.
They don't really get into great detail about which specific parts are from which book.
Okay.
It's more that it is just kind of from the universe of Kane horror, but presumably a lot of it is from the new book. But yes, the creepy fucking Village of the Damned Children running around chasing the dog, that's no good.
That's no good. And then Sam Neill's character, John Trent, he's loving it, man. He's like, this is great. You guys are putting on a fantastic publicity stunt.
Some great actors here.
Actors, you guys are going to kill it.
Hidden speakers in the corners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you guys went all out. This is fantastic.
Well, I mean, they get the room at the inn, and then, like, this is another one of my favorite parts. This, again, is, like, the good version of what is real, what the fuck's going on. Reality is being bent every which way to me, where they're arguing in the room, and he's just like, you're full of shit. This is all a big put on. She's like, no, I'm paraphrasing. Like, she's like, you don't understand. Like, this is exactly what he wrote about. And he's like, oh yeah, well, if that was true, then there would be a church with this and this and this and this detail right outside this window. And he flings the curtains open and there's nothing. It's like a barn. She's like, no, you didn't read closely enough. The view was to the east. She opens the other window and there is the exact church that he described.
What if Kane's work isn't fiction?
This is reality. Hear that?
Reality.
Now, what you're saying is true. There should be, out that window, a black Byzantine church with 250-foot spires with gold onions on the top. Now look. You see? Reality.
You didn't read closely enough. The view is from the east.
Yeah.
And he's just like gobsmacked. Like, that was a good creepy. He's just like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
And I feel like that shot doesn't, and that bit doesn't work if that church doesn't have this incredibly imposing presence. But my God, that church, it's like, I understand it's just a Catholic church, but like, that is definitely one of the most menacing looking Catholic churches I've ever seen outside of like old Europe.
Right. It does have an old European look to it in the middle of this like sleepy New England hamlet. Like it looks like it clashes or shouldn't be there in this type of town from this era.
Right.
Which makes it even weirder.
And I mean, that's the thing, is that it shouldn't exist. Is the lore of this is that there was a regular old church there And then the Black Church came and it swallowed up the old rectory, and that all that remains is, you know, the above the door mosaic of the battle between heaven and hell. And it's just like, you know what? They nailed it with that. That thing does not look like it belongs in this rural field in New England / Canada.
I think when they go to the church, which is pretty much the next scene, you kind of get the first Eldritch horror, Lovecraftian real hit on the nose, which is, that's the angel. Let me guess, angel fighting a demon. And she's like, oh no, I mean, it's a depiction, but you can't illustrate it. It's too horrifying to describe what the demon would look like. So you couldn't render it. They would make you mad. And I was like, oh, that is that the horrible angles, right? The maddening geometry.
The things that should not be.
Yeah, you can't render this. No human mind could comprehend this madness. And then, this is about the point where this movie feels like it intentionally kind of starts to turn into a fever dream, right?
Yeah.
This is when the locals come and start yelling for Kane.
Okay, and I just, real quick here, the lead local, the guy who gets all the lines.
Uh-huh. Don't say it. Hang on. Don't say it. Can I guess?
Yes.
I don't know if this is going to be right or not.
Go on.
That's not Viggo the Carpathian, is it?
It super is.
Oh my god.
Yes.
I didn't even make that connection until you started to say, wait, hang on, there's something about that guy. And I was like, wait, no.
This is Wilhelm von Homburg, the actor who played Viggo the Carpathian, whose voice was replaced by Max von Sydow in that movie. But here he gets to actually use his voice.
Wait, what?
Wait, you didn't know that was Max von Sydow in Ghostbusters 2?
No.
Yeah.
No, I did not.
Yeah, so here's the thing about Wilhelm von Homburg. Actually, there's a couple of things. We'll start here. He's not a good actor and does not talk well. And when they filmed him for Ghostbusters 2, they were like, this isn't going to work. So they replaced him with Max von Sydow and didn't tell him.
That hurts.
No, don't awe, because here's the thing. Wilhelm von Homburg is genuinely maybe one of the worst people to ever work in Hollywood.
Oh.
Wow. Maybe I'm slightly, because there have been some real monsters in Hollywood, but like...
I mean, we've got Charlton Heston in this movie.
Yeah, but here, well, this guy, I think, even overshoots Heston in some ways, so every story I've ever heard of any production that worked with him said he was just a gigantic asshole, like impossible to work with, like a huge dick. And there is an article, if you are interested at all, it was written, I think Deadspin put it out, because originally Homburg, real name Norbert Grupa, was a pro wrestler in the 50s and 60s, I believe with his father, and that was kind of how he got his start in show business. And there's a whole detailed article about this is the title of the article: The Hateful Life and Spiteful Death of the Man Who Was Viggo the Carpathian.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, his dad was like a Nazi soldier, and like his whole family was completely fucked in a whole bunch of different ways. And it sounds like Wilhelm was just a real piece of shit.
Okay.
But it is a really interesting article, if nothing else. But it was just very jarring to see him turn up here and talking, because the only other thing I think I've ever seen him in was Ghostbusters 2, where he does not use his own voice.
Wild. I was just looking at a little bit of his biography, and it's kind of wild.
Yeah, he had a really wild life, but also piece of shit.
Uh-huh. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Jeez.
And then he rolls up on this church with a gun and starts shooting in the air and hollering at the door.
Yes.
Kane!
Kane!
Give us the boy!
And then the door starts flapping around and the boy's there. And then eventually, who should appear?
A very well put together Sutter Kane.
And who is Sutter Kane?
He was in the opening credits. I knew he was in this movie, and yet I didn't recognize him when he showed up, and not again until the end credits did I realize, oh, that's who that was. Oh, that was Jürgen Prochnow.
Yes, that is our Das Boot captain.
Oh, like, right!
Like, I don't know how I, like, knew he was in this movie and still didn't put two and two together when I saw him.
That's so funny. Like, when I saw him, I just thought, like, man, this guy looks so familiar. I know this guy from somewhere.
Dude, this zoom-in shot with the lightning on his face the first time he is revealed in this movie is the platonic ideal of a creepy 90s horror fiction writer.
Yes, 100%.
With the crazy hair and the not, like, kind of turtleneck-looking trench coat.
Yes.
Get up. Like, it quite literally looks like a real-life author, like horror author from that era in a promo shot for some TV commercial or something.
Yeah, that would be like the back of the jacket photo, totally. And, so the Jürgen Prochnow now is here for a brief second, just to let you know that he's in this movie and he's here to fuck shit up. And before we get into what happens afterward, we gotta take a quick break, so we'll be right back. All right, we are back, and now Sutter Kane is here, and all hell is breaking loose, my friends.
I love that all hell breaking loose just means a bunch of Dobermans run out of nowhere and start chasing everybody.
Those dogs are really mean.
I believe it, but it's just like, this movie's supposed to be full of eldritch horrors. The first thing they really spring on him is just a bunch of dogs.
Not only just Dobermans, like well, manicured, collared Dobermans come out and start harassing these stuntmen in the stuntman being hit, bit by dog position, which is forearm and lower leg. Listen. Nothing against it. I don't want to see any dogs actually tearing people apart, but you can definitely tell this is like one of those early men in fire suit running around.
Yes.
Shots of these dogs. These are good dogs, and there are lots of them.
Yes, there are lots of them. Sutter Kane said, "Release the hounds," and the townspeople go flying. And then, you know, at this point, it's kind of clear that like Stiles is starting to believe that something truly supernatural is happening here. Trent is still not wholly convinced. He's still trying to talk his way out of it, reason his way out of it. But you know, things just kind of keep snowballing from there.
It's after this. So they go back to the hotel at this point?
Yes.
And then Stiles wants to go investigate more, and Trent is kind of like,
He's pissed. He's like throwing a tantrum, like rapidly packing his bags. Yeah. Also, she randomly tries to make out with him.
Like, she's trying to convince him to stay, but I think that is more the result of, like, her psyche starting to break, and she's desperate to try and get him to believe her.
It definitely seems like the madness is taking hold here a little bit, although she hasn't really experienced the, like, inciting event that truly sends her over the edge yet. Mm-hmm. And then he basically packs a bag and just, like, wants to get the fuck out, and, like, oh, the painting has changed again.
And she steals the car keys and splits.
But he's at first down there arguing with the... Here's another example of him being a huge asshole. Like, the proprietor asks him not to smoke in the lobby, and he just keeps smoking.
Yes.
She's like, please, no smoking. And he's just like, oh, I just can't seem to help it, and he just doesn't even care.
I mean, to be fair, that proprietor has some other really grim shit going on.
But she's great.
Also, yes, this is... when you realize that she is, in fact, the person from the previous book who hacked up her husband.
Yeah.
He's at the pre-hack stage.
He's laying there in handcuffs on the floor, like, groaning.
Naked.
Naked.
Kicks him in the face or whatever, but...
What does she say? She has some line where he asks her something, and she's like, oh, hell no. I forget what she says, but it's something funny, like, hey, are you doing this? Oh, hell no, I don't know.
No smoking, please. It bothers my husband.
I'm sorry, I just can't seem to help myself around here. Just on my way out, I thought I'd stop and admire the artwork.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Sure is. Stiles told me you painted it yourself.
Stiles? Oh, you mean the pretty young thing you came in here with? I don't know her at all. She know me?
Well, she claims she does. So you're not responsible for this?
Hell no.
She seems very like, I've got other bigger shit to do. I mean, don't know what you're talking about.
She is starting to have the change of life, shall we say, slam into her in a way that she's probably not prepared for. But
Yeah. She does a good job.
But this is also the part where they, right before Styles takes off, this is the part I think where she lets loose that there actually was a publicity stunt that was designed for the Kane thing,
right.
But none of this was part of it.
Right, that's because he's like going off like, oh, you can't fool me, this is all a bunch of bullshit. And she's like, no, I know it's real because we did plan a publicity stunt, it's just that Sutter Kane
never arrived. Yeah,
he never showed up. Like, all of this has to be real because this is not what we put together.
Yes, they wanted him to disappear for a bit, right? And he just
he never reappeared.
And then, yes, this is definitely the point where things get truly insane for the entire rest of the movie, where, like, Sam Neill is off in the bar with Vigo with blood all over his face,
mm-hmm.
who's basically telling him, like, what the fuck are you, you, get out of here while you can.
Yep.
And then she goes to the church.
Oh, it's Mommy's Day.
Oh, my God, dude.
It's Mommy's Day at the church.
Today is Mommy's Day.
Dude, that little girl's fucking monster makeup is one of the creepiest looking things I think I have ever seen.
Oh, she's straight up, looks like Quado from fucking Total
Dude,
Recall.
It's like, how did you convince a small girl to sit for that kind of makeup and look at herself in the mirror looking like this? Like, I wouldn't be able to handle that. I would look.
Child like actors are a different breed, man.
Take one look at myself in the mirror and run screaming from myself.
She goes, you're our mommy. And it's Mommy's Day, which is a pretty good line, if just totally ridiculous.
Like, the dog is missing a leg, but seems totally unbothered by it.
They're also playing ball out there.
A fair amount of the effects work is pretty cheesy in this movie, but that makeup, that getup that she's in is fucking gross.
It's pretty good.
It's
creepy. She hauls ass to the church after that, which I don't blame her, goes inside and encounters a very, again, well put together, very... composed Sutter Kane, who's just clacking away on the old keyboard.
I think he's like finishing the book here, right? I think
he's working on it. Yeah,
right, working on it.
And this kind of goes back to my statement from last time, which is that there is nothing creepier in this world than someone typing weird, or in this case, someone typing normally in a very weird room.
It's an extremely weird room, but he's super composed and just wants to share the work with Styles. Just really, their conversation is just. Doesn't really go anywhere. He's just kind of like, you know,
it has kind of a hypnotic effect on her, it seems like. Whatever Sutter says, she kind of falls under the thrall of it.
Linda, nice to see you again. You can edit this one from the inside. Looking out. It's funny, isn't it? For years, I thought I was making all this up. But they were telling me what to write. Giving you the power to make it all real. And now it is. Horrible, slimy things trying to get back in. They are true. Come. See the instrument of their homecoming. What you have come looking for? The new Bible. It starts the change. Helps you see.
Well, then he shares the book with her by shoving her face down onto it as if some office bully was clowning on her by shoving her head into the photocopier.
Yes.
Like, it it is just the stack of pages in the manuscript, but the way it lights up when he pushes her face down, like, all I could think was just like somebody's pulling a photocopier prank at work.
Stop photocopying yourself.
She absorbs it all and all the B-roll from the film straight into her noggin, and then she's all in.
She's so got, like, the eye bleeding thing.
That's the kind of stuff I was talking about earlier that I don't love, and like, I, now that I'm scrubbing through the movie again, like, maybe there's not quite as much of it as I thought there was, but it's the, I don't know, I think of it as very, like, mid-90s TV series, miniseries, like, hallucination montage type stuff, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just like a lot of overwrought symbolism of, like, really quick cuts of a bunch of random shit that may or may not be intended to be very deep. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, meant to just be horrific imagery more than anything else.
Kind of, yes. Like, there's, I don't know, there's not that much of that in here, but...
I mean, it's not like the end of Event Horizon, you know? It's not like you're seeing that horrible montage of, like, people on pikes or whatever. Like, it's just, it's stuff from the movie.
Like there's definitely some good, genuine, creepy horror shit in this movie. In the vein of, like, what is real, and, oh my god, this is very ominous and weird, but that stuff, I don't know, that stuff just comes off as, like, a little indulgent to me.
I think indulgent works for this movie. I think this is the kind of thing where you can really kind of lean into that stuff. I think Carpenter is the kind of director that can pull it off, and I think the story they're trying to tell here, it works. But I know what you mean, and yes, it is definitely, like, an overused trope from this era of horror.
During this part, though, this is when I actually kind of like this part, because it's super gross. She goes to make out with Sutter. And then had we not seen the back of Sutter this entire time?
No.
I'm not. Well, okay. So,
well, I mean, he's just walking. Yeah, I mean, you can see that thing is not there in any
other
shot.
You can. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Because you get a monster coming out of the back of Sutter Kane.
It's pretty good.
That she's, like, stroking or about like to stroke.
Like, that is good, creepy, gross effects work.
Oh, it's great. And that's the thing, is that, like, I don't think it's that that thing is there all the time. I think it's just that because he's starting to, you know, now that she's in, he can kind of let his guard down. Like, the things that are, you know, permeating inside his fucking blackened soul or whatever are starting to come out.
It's kind of the very Lovecraftian concept of sort of, like, third sight type stuff, you know, of, like, seeing the reality behind reality, like, oh, your third eye is open. Like, now you're seeing what the old ones are.
And I think that's part of why I like this movie so much is, again, I hadn't really read any Lovecraft up to this point, but, like, in the ensuing years, I've appreciated that this movie, I think, does a really good job of capturing the spirit of Lovecraft while excising all the race science bullshit.
Fair enough.
It's a cinematic version, which most movies don't do a good job of capturing the vibe of Lovecraft.
I'm kind of half with you. I think the vibe is there. I don't know. I'll save it for the end. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there is just something about that style of horror that visual media kind of can't capture, but we can get into that later.
We should talk about it later, because there is some interesting stuff they're trying to do, but I'm kind of with Brad. I'm not sure it works. But we do get the Sutter Kane kind of reveal here, that he feels like he is just a vessel. He's been writing these books and realizes, oh, I thought I was making it up, but really I'm just kind of...
They were telling me what to write the whole time.
That's right, a conduit, and kind of puts the final check mark next to, these are not just entertainment. These are kind of mechanisms for madness in the human race. This is the popularity of this and people rioting and all of this is to tear down the sanity walls within the human race to make way for whatever's on the other side of the veil.
Yes, and what's on the other side of the veil is, you know, in this case, very much, you know, if not specifically the old gods, let's just say creatures of ancient variety that definitely have not walked the earth in a very long time.
Yes, let's make way for some old order to come through.
But before that can happen, John Trent has to run around town like a chicken with his head cut off for a while, getting chased by various townspeople.
Or not really chased, just kind of pulling the car within 50 feet of them, turning around, driving back, pulling the car. Like, he's stuck in a loop. He can't escape.
He has time to stop by the bar again and watch Viggo blow his head off.
Yep.
Oh, that's what Viggo also says. I shouldn't exist. I don't know if I exist before the town or after the town, or I don't know. Am I real?
like that could have been, if they had leaned into it more, my favorite aspect of the movie. Is any of this actually real, or is it just because he wrote it this way? Like,
yeah,
is Trent actually just the protagonist in a novel and not even a real person? Like, stuff like that. But they do actually provide a fair amount of, so this is like the thing that bugs me about that kind of indulgent hallucination stuff that I didn't expect is when they never really make good on, like, what the fuck does any of that mean? Right. But like, they actually go out of their way to be like pretty explicit about what's going on here, which is that like, oh, these old gods live under this church and kind of want to breach our reality again. And they're using this guy's books to do it. And they even go out of their way to say like, oh, they got to the children first.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that they've reemerged and they took the children first. And so like, that's why you see all these creepy ass monster kids running around and et cetera.
And then the adults start to change over time.
Yeah.
And Viggo does explicitly say when he offs himself, because Trent's like, no, don't. And he's like, I can't help it. I'm written this way or something. This is what he wrote for me. Which
is a real like Jessica Rabbit. I can't help it. I'm just drawn this way kind of thing.
Yeah. There's also a Stephen King, a literal Stephen King short story, which now that I think about it, the title is maybe a little bit cheesy or ham-fisted, called Word Processor of the Gods. That quite literally is about being able to write anything you want into existence.
Okay.
But yes, it's quite a loop of him trying to drive frantically out of town and looping right back into the same downtown spot again, over and over and over.
It's good stuff. Long. And even my actual favorite bit from this whole section is this 2 second bit where one of the townspeople brushes by him as he's walking into the bar and just hisses, "Fuck you!
Fuck you!"
Right before going to join the other axe murderers. Like, it's so unnecessary, but I kind of love it.
And how does Styles wind up back in the car? She just manifests there?
She does.
Okay.
Well, he yes. tries. So there's a point where she's with the townspeople, and he basically like conks her over the head and throws her into the car.
Oh, wait, she punches him and then he punches her back, right?
And then and she swallows the keys in front of him, and he has to hotwire the car in 3 seconds.
With a screwdriver in the glove compartment next to his bike horn. He's got
this is how you know he's such a dirtbag, because he's able to do that fast.
This is definitely a guy who committed a lot of crimes. Like, he is the insurance fraud equivalent of like a white hat hacker.
Sure.
She swallows the keys, and this is, I swear, I thought he was going to lose a finger when he's like rummaging in her mouth to get the keys out. I was like, oh, he's just going to, this is going to be a John Carpenter rubber finger on the floor. But no, he emerges with all his fingers. And then until she gets out of the car, then stuff. Then,
oh my God!
Like that shot of just her head peeking around, like the actual actress, not the rubber mask later, but like you could just tell something ridiculous is about to happen. The way that nothing but her head peers around
the door,
I love this shot so fucking much. Oh
man, I want to love it.
It's just bad.
It could have been so goddamn creepy, but the face.
I don't know. I feel like for what they could do in $8 million movie budget,
is it really that cheap?
That's how much this movie had as a budget.
Okay, that helps actually explain some things.
I think what they were able to pull off with that shot actually doesn't look too rubbery.
It's everything but the mask is genuinely super creepy. Like, it's some real God, I'm trying to think, like, what games...
It's like very Japanese horror.
It's a little bit Dead Space. It's like the...
It's a little bit Exorcist Special Edition.
Like specifically where she's, like, crawling one way and then contorts her body around in reverse and keeps going and stuff. Like, it's all just... Ugh.
She's basically upside down head on a crab walk.
It's just the part where the face is just, like, emotionless and does not emote and is super rubbery.
It looks like a mask on somebody's upside-down head.
What they're going for.
It's not quite the human face on the dog in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but it's, like, in that neighborhood.
But, you know, it freaks out. It freaks out Trent. Does his job.
That would freak me the fuck out, too, man, even if that other shit hadn't happened.
Yeah, he is wholly freaked out. And does he get out at this point? Is that when he...
Sutter Kane kicks him out.
Yeah, this is where he ends up in the confessional in the church.
Right.
Yeah. This is kind of the final...
because he gets knocked out and then wakes up.
Yes. Yeah. This is basically the climax of the movie.
Yeah.
Where he ends up in the church.
And Sutter Kane just lays it all out for him. Just says, like, tells him about the old gods, tells him about what's behind that pulsating door, which, by the way, great pulsating door.
Yes. So, like, some of the effects to come here shortly did not work for me much at all, but that pulsing door is really well done. Like, because it's wooden. It's a big, gigantic wooden door, but they do a good job of making it look like real wood, but also making it bend.
It's
and
very
like,
wet.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, like,
it's
like
dripping.
Pulse and bulge in a way that wood should not do. It's really good.
We did skip the most the thing creature in here, which is when Kane's leaving the hotel, he spies the old lady in the basement chopping up the husband.
She has turned.
Yeah, she looks like she's straight out of the thing at that point.
Full tentacle monster.
Yeah.
Also, when Lydia comes back from the church, we also miss the part where, like,
you get the tentacles.
It's very clear she is fully all the way gone at that point, and then she goes behind that transparent door.
Yeah.
And yes, you see all these tentacles that look like they were literally left over from the thing.
Yes, the writhing,
like
stringy,
flailing around. Like, that visual of those stringy tentacles, like, flailing around like that is just, like, never not disgusting.
I wonder if he did the reverse shot again.
I think he did, and then there's also the painting. By that point, the characters in the painting have just straight up turned into tentacle mush.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it's all going bad for people in this town. And, you know, Kane basically just says, you have one job, dude, and that is deliver this manuscript. You have no choice. You have to do it because I wrote you that way. And you gotta go do it now because I can't hold these things back anymore.
You take the manuscript back to the world from me. That's what you do.
What I do.
You are what I wrote. Like this town. It wasn't here before I wrote it. And neither were you. No. I know what's real. I know what I am. And nobody pulls my strings. Did you think my agent attacked you by accident? He read about you. In there. He knew you'd bring it back and start the change. Make what's happened here happen everywhere. Try to stop you.
I'm not a piece of fiction.
I think therefore you are. Read it if you don't believe me.
And so, he unleashes hell, the dark gods, the evil ones. And I'm going to go out on a limb, Brad, and I'm going to say this is the effect shot that did not work for you quite as much. The part where he tears himself out of reality.
Oh, no, I love it. It's,
when Sutter Kane does.
It's not great. I mean,
it's a little funky looking.
It's great in that it was the best they could do with, like, very early, nascent digital effects in, what was this, 94?
It came out, so it was released at a film festival in 94. It came out wide in the U.S. in 95.
Mm. Okay, so, but I mean, yeah, this is right in that window. I mean, this is just after Jurassic Park. Like, CG of any kind is pretty damn new. It very much comes off like filmmaker trying out CG for the first time kind of stuff, and I really enjoy it for that reason. It is extremely, like, this is the best we can do with a digital image manipulation, like, just kind of taking stock, like, footage and ripping it apart, kind of.
Yeah. But as much as, like, that shot looks a little funky, I like the part that comes right after, which is just him staring into the maw while she narrates what is coming out at him. Like, there's a really good creepy bit there.
Yes, I enjoy that, and also when you get the shot from the other side of the hole in reality, it's all, like, pages of the book that have been torn open, which I thought was cool. The part that didn't work for me was it was only when they really start showing close-ups of what lives on the other side.
And that's getting into the part of, like, the Lovecraft thing, where it's, like, cinematically, it is very hard to show you the thing that cannot be described.
That's exactly what I was going to say earlier about visual media just struggling with Lovecraft. Like, I just think that nothing can ever top the dread and foreboding that your imagination can conjure up from things that are supposed to be inherently unknowable.
Totally.
So just, like, depicting those things in a concrete way is just always going to be kind of a losing proposition on some level.
And I think they're smart here in that, yes, there's a very elaborate monster here. Like I said, it took 25 people to animate this thing for the bit that they were showing.
Oh, this is what you were talking about. Okay, I thought it was, like, a bunch of different monsters, but I guess that's just the way they shoot it, is just a bunch of quick close-ups.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is I think they're smart about how they show it, because if you linger on it too long, you will see how rubbery and like, special effects-y a lot of that stuff is. But in the little flashes of it, you see enough that's like, oh, this is unpleasant. I don't want this thing chasing me.
This is the, like, part where Sam Neill's sprinting down the space corridor.
Yes, where he has been kicked out.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And then, man, so like the shit after this, when he's back in reality and just is alone on a highway, and his whole trek back to civilization from the middle of nowhere is great.
Yeah.
Because like that's exactly the kind of horror that this movie is trying to pull off that I think works really well, which primarily is that he's doing his damnedest to get rid of this manuscript, and it just won't leave him alone.
It shows up at the motel that he randomly shows up at. Like,
yeah, where did it go before that? Is that where he just left it on the highway?
I think so, yeah.
And then it shows up as a delivery with his name on it at the front desk.
Yeah. Who put you up for this?
And then he takes it and goes and burns it in the hotel sink. And I think it still comes back, right?
Well, what happens? He loses it that time, but then he's on the bus back to town, right. And Kane appears to him in a dream. He's like, hey, did you ever know my favorite color was blue?
Oh, yeah. Then he just wakes up and the footage has just got an extreme blue filter on it.
And he's just not having a good time.
The lady's got the blue hair.
He just starts screaming. And actually, I just realized it's another dream within a dream sequence here.
And then what happens is he gets back to the publisher. And Chuck Heston's there is like, it says two things. He's like, one, I didn't send anyone with you. They were out there solo. And
that
two,
part was, that was mean of him. He shouldn't have done that. That's poor Sam Neill at that point. He's had enough. Styles didn't exist, basically.
He should have just let him have that one.
Yeah.
But the other part is like, we got the manuscript weeks ago. It's been out.
Months ago. Because they're like making the movies coming out.
The movie's out in a week.
Yeah.
And that is where he snaps. That is where he's like, all right, fuck it. And he goes down to where they're selling the books. He sees the person with that weird double eye thing. And he just fucking's like, sorry. Axe to the forehead.
Yeah. I mean, it's bloody. It's the kid's bleeding from the eyes. Does he ask him if you read Sutter Kane? I don't remember.
I believe he does.
Okay. Takes the old fire axe to him. Also there's a pretty good bit where there's a recurring bit. He keeps walking by a Mouth of Madness poster or a Hobbs End poster.
It's a Hobbs End horror poster.
Yeah. And he, there's like a tear in it. He's always like kind of poking behind the tear, but he never tears the whole poster down. It's on a concrete wall. And at the end he tears it off when he's starting to really lose it all. And there he is, the poster boy, Sam Neill, on the cover of Mouth of Madness.
It's a really good illustrated version of Sam Neill.
Yeah. So like he's lost it. He takes the axe. He thinks he's the only one who can stop it. These people are being indoctrinated by their eldritch god. And it winds up in the sanitarium.
And I think the ultimate realization there is that he knows he can't stop it. And, like, him going to the sanitarium is very much him being like, this is the only place I can stay away from whatever is about to come.
He's not entirely wrong.
He has a great line. What does he say to the guy who's interviewing him? He's like, if you're talking to me, it must be really bad out there.
Yes.
It must have gotten
pretty fucking bad.
Yeah, yeah. Which is like, oh, man. Oh, there's this also this weird, I don't know what you want to call it. It's not philosophical, but it's a little like, I smoke some weed, let's talk about what reality is.
Isn't that what philosophy is?
There's a subplot of like, what is reality? Reality could always change. It's just the people who are in charge. What does she say? Styles says, like, if it were reversed, you'd feel pretty lonely if this were the only reality. And like, I think that's what you're supposed to get from, like, Sam Neill is maybe one of the only sane people left in an insane world, right?
Right. Well, that's the point, is that, like, yes, once reality shifts and once the people who establish reality become the minority,
yes,
you're treated as the insane one.
Right. So this, I think this person who's interviewing him is supposed to be one of the only sane people, right? Because he doesn't read Sutter Kane, this person who's interviewing him.
Oh, he will.
Oh, he's going to see the movie.
I mean, this is kind of it, though, because, like, that very night, apparently the world ends. Like, in that conversation, right before David Warner walks off, like, Sam Neill starts talking about, like, the end of a species.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we're done.
Eventually a species will die off and there will be nothing left but memories or traits, whatever, anyway.
Yeah. We'll be bedtime stories for their kids or something.
I'm going to leave now, but I'll be coming back. No, Harry. It's safer in here now. It'll get worse out there.
every species can smell its own extinction. The last ones left won't have a pretty time of it. And in 10 years, maybe less, human race will just be a bedtime story for their children. A myth. Nothing more.
Right. And, yeah. then there is, from his perspective in the padded cell, a bunch of horrific violence going on outside all night.
Things banging on the door, like screams. Yeah, like it's it sounds bad. It sounds real fucking bad.
His door is torn, almost torn off the hinges, and then he wanders out in the morning, and I think the world has ended.
It's pretty empty out there.
Yeah, there's just like smoking ambulance, you know, no one around, like whole place is trashed.
I mean, the entire asylum has been, trashed, and there's blood everywhere, and everything is destroyed, and this news report on the radio is basically just saying, like, there's almost nobody left.
Yeah, it's very Fallout. Three Dog's going to keep broadcasting as long as he can.
This incredible epidemic of mass killing has spread to every country in the civilized world, is what this radio broadcast is saying.
That book got translated and put out, and the movie got translated and put out pretty quickly.
Oh, I completely glossed over the detail. I just took it as, like, files from the asylum or something. But, like, when he wanders out of his cell, like, every inch of the world outside of his cell is just covered with book pages everywhere.
Mm.
Like, every bit of everything you see.
I didn't pick that up either. From the actual book?
Through the entire end of the movie, there are just ripped out book pages all over everything.
The word has spread. There's only one place left to go.
All right, and then you get the great shot right at the end of the marquee at the movie theater.
Let's all go to the movies and lose our fucking minds.
Like, it literally just says, In the Mouth of Madness with John Trent on the marquee at the movie theater.
And this last bit, I think, is one of my favorite Carpenter bits. Like, I love this little scene here of Sam Neill just laughing himself into, let's just
it's
say,
like a
probably
scream
the
laugh.
Grave.
It's like a scream, yeah, cry
he's
laugh.
Like,
it's
he's
like,
almost sobbing by the end of
it.
This is not a Sutter Kane story. This is not reality. Not reality. Not reality.
This is reality.
Not reality. Not reality.
He is watching himself. He is watching what happened to him play out on the movie screen. And what else can you do in that situation but laugh?
So I think so I'm going to loop back around to something you said earlier, Brad. I think this is probably their most successful translation of Lovecraftian horror in a visual medium. Like, this plays into, like, oh, this is too horrible to believe, watching yourself in a it just makes no sense. You can't comprehend it.
I'm with you. Like,
this works. The other stuff, not so much. But this is a good, hey, how do you make that same stuff work in a movie? And this works for them, I think.
This and, like, him being taken by surprise by the church out the window and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like that, yes, I totally agree. Like, that's the stuff that works for me. Like, the rubber monsters, not as much.
But then the movie, so he sees that, he's like screaming, crying, laughing all at the same time, eating a gigantic bowl of popcorn, which, why not? Why not prepare a bowl
of
popcorn?
Yeah, why not splurge on the big one? You know, everything's coming down. Why not?
But then the movie, then credits roll, and I thought the movie was going to come back up. I thought we were seeing credits for the movie he was watching, but that's actually the end of the movie.
No, that's actually the end of the movie, is John Trent realizing that, you know, whatever reality he may have believed was once there, it was all Sutter Kane.
Was it always?
Or is it? Yeah. Or is it? Maybe everything's actually totally normal and this all exists in his head. Who can say?
Who can say?
Who can say?
Maybe he never went to Hobbs and...
Yeah, I still, like I said, I gain a greater appreciation for this movie every time I watch it. I think it is striving for some things, and on the budget that it has, it accomplishes a lot. I think trying to turn Lovecraft into a movie is ultimately a huge folly that nobody has ever really been able to do very well. But I think, oh wait, Brad's got a face. Brad's making a face. What is the face?
Well, sorry, real quick, just since we were talking about the ending, I have to say they do the very right thing and also end on that same opening credits or the intro theme.
Oh yeah.
Again. But the thing that made my jaw drop is Hayden Christensen, Anakin Skywalker himself, is in this movie. What the fuck?
Is he one of the kids? He must be one of the children.
Apparently, yes.
He would have been about that age, I guess. Yeah. Paperboy
is how he's credited.
Paperboy.
I'm going to have to go look that up.
That wouldn't be the kid on the bicycle.
I don't know.
Whoa, is he the kid on the bicycle?
Is it possible he's the kid
on the bicycle? Maybe.
He would have been about that age.
There are some shots of the actual kid before the old creepy makeup.
Oh, right, because
Star Wars,
episode one was like late 90s?
99, right? 98.
Well, 2002 was the first one he was in.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah, yeah.
Let me see if there's a shot of his face here. That sure does look... Oh my god, that is 100% him.
He's the kid on the bicycle?
That's amazing.
They totally is. That's wild.
You were supposed to be the one! amazing.
Well, it sounds...
I don't know. This is definitely the most uneven of the Carpenter movies we've watched, to me.
More so than Prince of Darkness?
I think I am kind of a Prince of Darkness apologist, actually.
Okay.
It seems... but I don't know, talking through this, like, I appreciate the parts that work more than I did coming straight off of watching it. There are just some parts that don't quite get there for me.
Vinny, it seems like you're of a similar opinion.
I think it is interesting. I think it's a little clunky, and I'm kind of with Brad in the sentiment that I wish they had gone harder on some of the things they start to put in there. Like, if they just put the pedal down a little bit more in some places about, they leave a lot up to the viewer, right? To kind of, you know, to kind of figure out, and that's okay. And I think you're not supposed to have answers to a lot of questions, and it's a dark ending, right? It's not a happy ending.
No. I mean, he seems pretty happy.
But there's something a little too cartoonish about a lot of it. Like the way the guy at the sanitarium, the assistant who's there, it seems like he is a cartoon character.
Yes, that hurt you.
Yes, John Glover's Dr. Saperstein.
Yeah, that guy. There's something like John Trent is just a cigar chomping cliche for a lot of it. There's just a lot of stuff that I think they do well, but I also think it's a little lost in some of the goofiness of it.
I think the stuff that works in this movie is probably more the work of Carpenter than, let's say, the screenwriter. Because, again, based on DeLuca's screenwriting career, I don't know that his chops were really the thing that made this movie's motor go. But I feel like Carpenter was the right director to try and bring this thing into, you know, something actually worthwhile. And I personally think it gets there. And, you know, again, like, the number of Lovecraftian movies is fairly small, and especially the number of successful ones is way smaller than that. I feel like maybe Color Out of Space is the only other one, which is a direct adaptation that kind of got there.
Hmm.
But in general, like, I don't know. Like, I have a weird appreciation for this movie. Part of it was maybe just the time when I saw it, but, like, I do enjoy it more and more over time. And, God, that opening theme just rips so fucking hard,
it's
dude.
Pretty good.
How did it do when it was released?
Not well.
Okay.
It was, like I said, it was an $8 million budget, let's say somewhere between 8 and 14 when you count marketing and all that stuff, and it only ended up making about 8 or 9 million total.
Yikes. I feel like I remember there being some buzz around it when it came out.
Yeah, it just, you know, it was one of those movies that, like, started a little weak and then just never really picked up steam. But, like a lot of other Carpenter movies, it gained an appreciation later on in the DVD and Blu-ray era.
I'm gonna put this on my list. Above Predator 2, but below Prince of Darkness. I think Prince of Darkness is a more interesting premise than this. And again, I don't think it goes as hard as it could, but it kept me a little more riveted to find out what happens than this. This is a flurry, intentionally or unintentionally so, of madness in the last third of it.
Interesting.
But that being said, do not forget The Thing. Above Jaws is my number one on this list.
Oh,
so
I know.
Far. Like, that is so of the Apocalypse trilogy, The Thing is amazing. Prince of Darkness and Mouth of Madness are of a kind, but just I think The Thing is light years ahead of it. I talked to my wife and she's like, "Really, The Thing?" And she's like, "The Thing is so cheesy." I was I was like, "No, you need to watch it again. The Thing is amazing."
In fact, you need to make her watch it several more times at least, just to make sure it really gets in there. Yeah, no, I mean, look, The Thing is my favorite Carpenter movie, and I think it is one of my all-time favorite movies. In the Mouth of Madness, I would put, personally, maybe above Close Encounters in terms of how much I enjoy it.
Okay.
But I wouldn't necessarily put it above any of the other movies that we watched. I just really like it.
I can see Sam Neill does great work in it.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm starting to appreciate parts of it more now that we've kind of given it a close reading or whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think it is interesting the way the Apocalypse trilogy, someone in our Discord pointed this out, like increases in terms of urgency of apocalypses with each movie. Like, The Thing is a very small scale thing that could turn into a giant thing, but doesn't.
Oh, it does. Darkness. Oh, it does. I mean, that's why it's in the trilogy, right?
Like, I feel like such a dope that I never even considered that he meant apocalypse literally in the sense that all three of these premises could result in an apocalypse.
I'm more convinced that The Thing is the end of humanity at the end of that movie, and that, you know, maybe not canonically going forward in the video game or whatever, but that The Thing.
I'm talking more about depiction in the film because, like, where the Thing ends, nothing has really kicked off outside of Antarctica.
Okay. Fair enough.
But, like, you know, in Prince of Darkness, they're only about 10 years, 12 years away from, you know, the fucking anti-god coming. And then here, it's like, he just walks straight out into murder town.
Yes, it has happened. He is in the apocalypse.
Yeah.
I'm more convinced now the end of The Thing is, no, The Thing. Somebody is The Thing, or it is frozen, and it will be the end of the world at some point. Fun time, Alex. Thanks so much. We have more Carpenter coming.
We do. So now that we are out of the Apocalypse trilogy, we do have a couple more Halloween-y Carpenter films coming up. And our next one is one I'm very excited to show to Brad. Because, again, you weren't sure if you'd seen it, but I'm pretty sure that you would remember if you had.
I don't think I have. I do not. I might watch that movie tonight. I'm not sure.
All right. We are going to do the Rowdy Roddy Piper classic, They Live. It is, again, another one of my favorite Carpenters, and I'm very excited to show it to Brad and to watch it again with you and talk about it with you, Vinny.
Yeah. I'm very curious, Brad. I find this movie very enjoyable. I think the messaging in it will be very interesting in a 2022 context, especially for you, Brad, if you haven't seen it.
Okay.
Well, get hype for that for next week. That will be They Live, and then again, we are rounding out the month at the end on Halloween. With Halloween, because how could we not?
I love
appropriate.
It. Yes.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for today's episode. Thank you for taking this journey into the maw of craziness with all of us. We will see you next time on the next Lander Watchcast.